In the middle of the night, I was mixing those up. I couldn't believe it.
Oh, they're hard. They're little.
I know, but I mean, I just forgot which one to do.
Yeah.
Which I thought.
Okay. So, can you hear yourself okay?
Okay. That's just fine.
Not too loud, not too soft?
It's just fine.
Okay, so then you can start whenever you're ready.
Okay. You give me the signal that says, I go. This is Jennifer Stone with Stone's Throw. I just can't do it. My little notebook this week is full of, first of all, the Forever War. You know, the guy who said, time to quit, you know. We'll quit after 20 years. The other thing is all about the British monarchy, and that is funny, but I don't like to laugh at somebody who lived to be 99. Elizabeth is something special. Maybe I can come up with a little story about her. There is a story about her. What I want to do today, I'm going to read you a story. And because we're obsessed with time lately, I am the Forever War and so forth, I'm going to really go back. This story was published in 1977 in a little book. And it was published in Mother Jones. Mother Jones did fiction in those days. They put stories in. They don't do that anymore. But I think now the story goes back even further. The story goes back to the 50s. And I thought it might be funny for someone like me who forgets everything now to go all the way back and try to get something from the deep, deep past. See if it's still got any punch, any oomph. Anyway, this story is called Beatific Blue. The Beats had come to the scene for me. They were all over the place. And, I said, oh, they're so beatific. Somebody said, that's not the right way to say it. And I said, okay, they're just beats. But Beatific Blue seemed to me to be perfect because I certainly wasn't a beatnik. I might have wanted to be, but I certainly was blue. Anyway, no interruptions. Late one morning in the San Francisco summer of 54, I walked to the Cafe of the Black Cat for breakfast. I was living in North Beach with a painter who wouldn't sleep with me. He wouldn't sleep with me, yes, he said he couldn't, because I was 20, and that made me still a minor. Back then, yes, 20. He had been in trouble over something like that long ago, he said. Anyway, I didn't mind because I had never properly slept with anyone up to that time. And because I just felt there was something missing, and he was probably queer, I said to myself, and he had a tooth missing. Queer. Yes, I'm putting an asterisk after that. No interruptions. He said he was having his tooth fixed, but he never did. At the Cafe of the Black Cat, I ate rolls and drank chocolate with this actor I knew. We sat at a little round table inside the Gilded Cage. Terrific little place. I think he told me, yes, he told me then that I should go to the Bella Union Theater right off Kearney, right? And he said that they're reading for a play over there. Now, he said he was sure that I was just right for it. Oh, well, I was, of course. It was my G.B. Shaw and the critic on the Chronicle, when the play came out, he called me a natural actress. I've never been able to figure out what that is. My first review in San Francisco, a natural actress. I'll work on that. Anyway, the play ran for 6 weeks. I stayed on with the painter, and I slept in the window seat. I tried peyote, and I listened to a lot of writers and musicians and anarchists and even actors. For the most part, they talked crap. I didn't think a person should take herself seriously unless she is alone. When you are alone, everything belongs to you, and you can't really offend yourself. Oh, yes, you can, yes. Anyway, all that goes for the men, too. It's rude, just rude. These people, they haven't figured out that nobody ever agrees with you completely. I mean, not really. Sometimes they would break down and cry over some issue or other. I was no intellectual, so half the time I didn't understand what the hell they were getting at. And they were all so emotional about what seemed to be trivia. Anyway, once a woman got furious about some pictures in the bathroom. Yes, typical. I see them. Chinatown. The pictures were vaguely prints of a fornicating couple. The woman in the picture was presenting herself to the man, who was partially undressed and leaning on one elbow. There were these little flames all around their genitals. I thought that the bland looks on their faces were supposed to be funny, but the woman who got furious slammed out of the bathroom. She gave the painter and his friends hell because she didn't think such pictures should be in the bathroom. I mean, where people could look at them while defecating, because that puts sex in the toilet. Lowered it to the level of a bodily function. One of the men said, well, eating is a bodily function. Aha. Oh, and then she got even madder. Finally, they both got stoned, and I think the argument was over, but she did go into the bathroom with one of the men. Maybe they were trying to test out whether they could imitate the couple in the picture. After a while, we heard them taking a shower together, so I guess it turned out all right. I wasn't so sure how I felt about all that bizarre stuff. Once I went to a party in a very modern, old-fashioned apartment where all but a few of the people were naked. Not nude, naked. They were dancing. Yes, and they looked kind of pathetic, I have to say. Especially the older ones. They were good looking, some of them, but that didn't seem to be any reason for their being so naked. None of the men had erections, for example. There was a young guy dressed in shorts and a t-shirt. He was sitting by the record player changing the records. I saw he had braces on his legs. When he went out to the kitchen, he wasn't naked. He tried to sit in place so that we didn't see the braces on his legs. One of his legs was longer or shorter, and so So he felt better, I think, about the walking. One of the women was curled up on the sofa with a silk scarf around her middle. She folded her arms around herself. Then she talked and laughed. She didn't like to laugh with her breasts hanging down. When she got up to dance, I saw that her breasts, were a little pathetic, and she was, though, very beautiful. I think the most beautiful woman there. Now, I just couldn't understand how she could be dancing like that in front of those men who hardly seemed to notice her. Ah, dear me. The hostess at the party was spectacular. She had exceptionally dramatic breasts. She carried a tray of food around and leaned over everyone, asking them to try something. Now, she was certainly old enough to be my mother, and she asked why I was dressed. Well, I told her I had spent half the afternoon dressing for this party, that blue was my favorite color. Besides, I wanted to be different. I was defensive as hell. I went into the bathroom to escape from the naked lady, the one old enough to be my mother. I went in there to fix my makeup. There I saw the director of my play, my Shaw play, standing there talking to a woman. She was in the corner, and he had his arm on her shoulder. He was kind of coming on very strong and pressing against her. I thought she looked intimidated. I took out a box of matches, and I struck one of the matches, and then let that one light up all the others, and I dropped those flames into the wastebasket. She yelled, "Fire!" And he turned around. I saw that he did have an erection. But by the time he got the wastebasket into the kitchen and put out the fire and made the other people calm down, both he and the cornered girl had disappeared. I sat down in the living room and began talking with a woman dressed in a wine-colored turban. She was sketching the nude figures, nude by now. I was stoned. It was a bit baroque, I thought. But what did I know? She was drawing the dancing girl, who still clutched her silk scarf. Ah, yes, the words scrawled at the bottom of the sketch were Death and the Maiden. I noticed the director, I noticed him come over and laugh. He had his clothes on by now, and he came over to look at the drawings. He said to her, "If people are not flowers or trees or temples," he said. "You are," said the woman. She put her sketches away. She said, "You are a liberal fig, if ever I saw one." The director told me I was too young to be at this party. I mean, let's see, I must have been 20, yes. And he would take me home. We went together to the Stone Pot for a drink. The Stone Pot was in those days a very simple, cheap bar and restaurant. The windows were painted over and sawdust on the floor. There was soup there, hot bread and mulled wine. Yes, it was on Montgomery Street. Ah, yes, just where it is now. But I felt as if it might be on the left bank, and I might be the last of the lost generation. Everything suited my imagination except the people. I thought being yourself meant being happy. The stage was set, but the actors had the wrong script. I expected the stage, to collapse under these actors, who just didn't have the right script. I expected to look up and see Gertrude Stein walk in with Alice. I didn't know Gertrude Stein had moved to Paris because it was cheaper than San Francisco. I was naive. Even at 20, I thought I was becoming myself, that I was finding my milieu. I felt it was my coming out summer. Chronologically speaking, I think that was the same summer Sylvia Plath was in New York, you know. She worked at one of the women's magazines, and then she went home and tried to kill herself. Anyway, she was there, I think, 53. Anyway, it was the summer before our senior year, the summer that she wrote about in The Bell Jar. She saw the dark side of the moon. I saw stars. I sat in Vesuvio's, and I was the next great lady of the American theater. How could I know? I was Thumbelina without the tulip. Anyway, this director, he took me to the Stone Pot after that nude party. He was very paternal. I think he thought I had the illusions of grandeur. He told me that the woman at the party, the artist, was a lesbian and therefore a sort of psychological translation. Once removed, yes. Mm-hmm. Women were okay, but she needed to meet the real thing. Anyway, it seemed he was saying that she wasn't up to the real thing. No, she had to grow into that. I don't know where those impressions came from. They're still around. After that evening, the director paid more attention to me. He noticed all the artifacts sitting on my dressing table backstage. Ha ha. All my magic. Yes, I had magic tokens and candles and all those things that worked for me. Little symbols. I don't know. I could tell he was touched by all that nonsense. I had all the appearance and attributes of a precocious child. Idiot child, though. Then one night, an actor didn't show up. The director had to take his part. He came backstage to make up, and he watched me with his arms over my head, having my somewhat minimal breasts taped as high as they would go so they would bulge out of my costume. Then he watched, and he saw me paint in a cleavage, you know, darken your cleavage. Looks like you have more breasts. Anyway, he looked at my grease paint, and he laughed. He was impressed, actually. He was impressed. I considered. Now, the Bella Union is a very old theater, the oldest in town. I think it shows old movies now. I think it's disappeared, of course. Porno films for a while. Anyway, it dates back to the old Barbary Coast. There is almost no backstage. The area there is just about big enough to step across, except the basement. There was a basement underneath where we could go to sit, but you had to get on stage by sliding down a pole like firemen. There was a kind of a ladder there too, but you know what I mean. I think one time I had to exit by that fireman's pole, and I went down a spiral staircase with the pole, and I had to get off stage in a hurry. And that night, the director caught me. He caught me coming down the pole. Well, I decided he would do. I had half a summer left, and the painter let another guy move in his place. So it was pretty crowded. The director was really rather old, 40 or so. But he was a kind of hipster, of course. Everyone thought he was cool. He had all the kinds of appetite, you know, that I don't like to tell you about, indeed, yes. He had, you know, the appetites, but very bad digestion, yes. He also had a name, but that's too biblical to mention. There were a lot of people now. Everyone slept with everybody, and I mean went home with them and slept with them. I don't know. The people, everybody thought they were, well, important. You know, if it wasn't Paris, it was the San Francisco North Beach. That was meetnik enough for them. 40, I thought. 40. 20 and 40. Now, I think something happened one night. We went over to the Marin Woods. I don't know if I can really tell you about it. It was a beautiful house. The guy who owned it, he had a newspaper in San Francisco. And, oh, wow. I thought it was a perfect place to be seduced. Indeed, seduced. I mean, everybody there was doing it. And I saw these great redwood trees, and I remember taking careful mental notes of what I was wearing and what everyone said. I even wrote it down in a diary. I saved it for years. 10 years later, I ripped up some of it and just left the pretty stuff. I don't know. I just never did get any orgasms with him. I had been exposed to the women's magazines, and I thought you were, you know, supposed to do the whole thing with smile on your face. I didn't know how to get orgasms for myself. I mean, not with a man around, yes. It was very confusing because I think he thought he was the cat's meow. Anyway, I just didn't know how to get them for myself, not with a man. And I had been reading the wrong books, I think. I had the notion that orgasms were something a man was supposed to give you. Mm-hmm. Well, most men sure as hell try, I'll say that much. I think they must read the same magazines I do, or worse, they read D.H. Lawrence, yes. I mean, when they just stop being in charge every minute and slow down now and then and stop performing, everything comes fine. Damn the finger fucking 50s. Nearly ruined me. Men confuse sex with athletics or with theater, which is worse. It was all part of the phallocentric fallacy. That men could do it for you. You know, live your life, pay your bills, give you babies, whatever. It was years before I found a man who let me come on my own, much less create my own. I think it may still be difficult, but 1951, 54, I'm telling you, so long ago, ignorance, no sophistication, anyway. Most nights, after the show was over, we would all go to the other place. I loved it. The other place. We would drink there. But I was a liability. Not that anyone asked for my ID. I looked decadent as hell in those days. I wore black leotards and mauve fingernail polish. I always left great smears of makeup around my eyes. Colette advised Cole. Yes, it looks like Cole. I read that that pictures of Colette showed her as a kind of zombie. She seemed to black out her whole the whole eye up above to the eyebrow. I think those pictures were when she was old. But I still did that too. Morticia Adams on the corner of Columbus and Kearney, I thought. Anyway, someone always gave me plenty of wine. One night, the director asked me what we were going to eat for breakfast. I told him I had $2 and a pack of gum. Everyone got to talking about my going to an expensive girls' school and how I must be loaded. I must be a debutante or something. And I told them I was on a scholarship and didn't even have an allowance anymore. I had them look at my diary and I said, look, you see here, my father found this in my closet while I was down in L.A., summer theater in L.A., yes. I don't know. I went away to act with a stock company, yes, in Laguna Beach. But this summer, I was at UCLA, and I don't know. I never thought he would pick it up and read it. I just forgot. Anyway, my father got very maudlin about the whole thing. It surprised me. I had forgotten it. I had completely forgotten it. He was an MD. He knew all adolescents hate their parents. Always. I mean, anyway, I had no money for breakfast or anything else. The director was already paying child support to some woman he had been married to years before. He began to look at me with less enthusiasm, and that child support put the lid on his party time, you know. I wanted to go down to Carmel, but I couldn't drag him down. He laughed mostly. Of course, I didn't think money was important. I thought it was absolutely irrelevant. He laughed. He said I was bourgeoisie. I couldn't help being this unsophisticated lass. I said yes, but I was a child of depression as well. I went back to visit that bar last year, a place called The Other Place. I expected to see him sitting there under the naked light bulb. It's expensive as hell now, full of hippie tourists, but he's still sitting there. He's the one with the gray hair, the sandals, and the Indian beads, the one with the young woman with the long, straight hair. Anyway, one morning, there was a horrible noise. The director's girlfriend, I mean his real girlfriend, was throwing shoes at his door because I was in his bed. Now, she lived in another apartment just up the stairs. And I had stayed at her place a few times just after the play opened, she told me that she was sick of him, that he was insincere and not the sort of man to take seriously. Now, I had believed her because I didn't understand women. Who does? Anyway, she had a charming apartment. She had a fixed arty and lots of streamers and colors, the colors. She kept going to shrinks and that sort of thing, but she had lots of sunlight and plants and bright paint, all kinds of bright paint. And she seemed to be very happy, but I didn't know that she was really angry with this guy. There was a bottle of Arpège in her icebox, flowers in the window. Everything was very clean and cared for. She used an English accent when she wore Arpège. She was a red-headed Jewish girl from New York. She let me sleep on her couch, and she gave me a quilt, two pillows when I stayed with her. She always loaned me a shorty nightgown. She would call in sick sometimes when she was sick of her job. She would say that she wasn't feeling very bouncy, or her cat died or something. I have tried to remember things he said that were charming. He didn't talk about her, and certainly he was too sure of himself to give it an analysis after the show fight. I took all the shoes back, and I was too embarrassed to say anything. Worst of all, a friend of mine was sitting in her kitchen. Someone at the theater had given him the address, but this guy went to the wrong apartment. Now, he was a friend. He was a homosexual who was in the plays at my school. Girls' school. Had to go out and recruit actors. He was always giving me good advice. He sent me a card on my opening night saying, "They loved you in Oakland." He had decided to look me up. When he found himself in the wrong apartment, he also found an ally. He asked her to rescue me. He was horrified at the garbage cans in the hall outside the apartment. Pretty raunchy, anyway. The director kept his place. Rank, and very dark. My friend came in, but he wouldn't sit down. He stood around like the dean of my college, saying stuff like, "Remember who you are and what you represent." He said I better get my bourgeois butt out of there before the axe fell. Well, I could see it wasn't Paris. I wasn't Picasso's mistress. I couldn't help believing it was bohemian and liberating, even though I knew it probably wasn't going to be my real life. I saw something I thought was the new wave. I saw the ones later called the Holy Barbarians, the Beatniks, the black and white jazz and poetry writing and retreating, talking and repeating Beatniks. This was San Francisco anyway, and I had come to town. My name was in the papers. I was appearing on the boards. We used to go see Mort Saul at the Old Hungry Eye. Those days, it was just across the street from the theater, and Mort Saul would just be sitting at the end of the bar, and he would read stuff from the newspapers, and everyone would buy him a beer, and he would start to talk, and he had an act in the room with a brick wall behind him. Well, I could tell something was beginning. I knew we were all beginning, and that was what mattered. I began to think I might be in love. I went to visit the painter. I wanted to tell him that I was in love with the director of my play. Now, he was having a party. Everyone brought something and cut it up, put it in a big frying pan, and the painter stood there stirring and stirring. I don't remember eating it. Anyway, now and then someone new would come, and they would add something to the stew. Let's call it a stew. The painter just stood there stirring. He said he had thought about marrying me himself. He told me that that was why he hadn't slept with me when I lived in his apartment. He said he knew all along that I was a virgin, and he could see now that I had no instinct at all for who had my best interests at heart. He told me I was making an awful mistake. You know, with that director, awful mistake. And I wouldn't get any results. It didn't point to a very nice future, he said. Then I said, who the hell was talking about getting married? For Christ's sake. He didn't want to get married, for Christ's sake. No, no, no. I had to finish school, had to go to the moon. This didn't get through to him. I did not understand sexism. But sexism goes so deep, it's hard to see. We think it's just reality. I really, really thought that I had the privileges of a white man. That is, until I was a white mother. That got through to me. I remember my father warned me. When I was 16, my father told me to get married and then do what I liked. I told him we weren't living in the Middle Ages. He smiled. Yes, of course we are. Anyway, I did get married once, a few years later. Me and Sylvia Plath. Same year, I think. Then we had our babies. Same years. When the babies were still in their cribs, Sylvia decided to gas herself. I just left home. Drive back to town. Put the kids in the car, yes. I just went away, left away. I hadn't gone to the moon. I had gone to Walnut Creek and back. Oh, it wasn't 1954 anymore. I remember I went to look for some of those people sometime in 1966, you know, at the height of the culture clash. Those wonderful, amazing years. I don't know. There were some outlaws left. They were living across town in the Haight-Ashbury. They were into color and flowers. Oh, and sound, the black tights. And the loose words were pretty much all gone. Well, no, some of us, yes. No one wrote all over the menus. Oh, I saved some of those menus with the poems on it. Anyway, no one wrote on the tablecloth or on the table or anywhere. But in the toilets, yes. My favorite, yes, is over at near the park. They wrote alone. My favorite was don't debate, create. I guess that's okay. When I got to be a school teacher, I tried so hard. Teach the kids some wit. Yes, little Oscar Wilde. Anyway, When I was over there in 66, I went to a place where the Blackjack Club used to be. And I listened. I heard the woman there who used to sing Little Girl Blue. She made everyone cry. This was a gay bar. I remember everyone cried, and I remembered how she would imitate Marlene Dietrich with giant black fans, and I remembered how I had loved her so much more than the man I was in love with. Then I remembered what I had forgotten. I remembered a night at the House of India. I remembered a newspaper man that I knew but didn't love until much later. He told me all about myself. Some of it was true. First, he gave me too many gimlets. I began to think the bartender was Trevor Howard. The waiters were students at UC Berkeley. They wore fezes and spoke in dialect. The man I didn't love yet said that if we would have to change, yes. Too many Ingmar Bergman movies, he said. You can't be in love when you're this young and all you do is see grim films. When she made Casablanca, Ingrid Bergman was, I believe someone said she was 19 or something. Anyway, very young. I don't think that's possible. She could be 19. Anyway, she said that she was in love with the piano player. Julie Wilson, I think it was. Anyway, he told me, yes, he told me that I wouldn't believe it, at least for about a decade. He asked me why I thought my lover didn't believe himself. He was on view in his apartment, but no one believed in him. Then he told me, yes, the piano player, Sam, that's the love of any romantic woman's life. And I think, you know, once we figure that out, we've got a lot of material to work with. Don't remember, Sam, yes. This nice man, this newspaper man, he said I should go back to school and act on my own stage and stop hanging out. Well, I never got much older. When I came back to town in 1966, I felt so lonely. Perhaps I'd been lonely before, but it's easier to be lonely alone. There was chanting, feeling, and psychedelics, images, and circles. But I couldn't find anyone who would talk to me. They told me that the Tao that was spoken is not Tao. Which is true, unless you call it spoken Tao. I did not want to quibble, as I could feel. It was getting late in the age of the 20th century. I was getting getting on board. So late in my age that the words had lost their meaning. Once you said them, something died. Yes. Anyway, I didn't like to start getting sloppy and nostalgic. I mean, to get to the end of my story, I fade into flashbacks, lying, nostalgia, because, of course, no one remembers, right? Well, I mean, nostalgia ain't what it used to be, but we never remember exactly. I didn't develop the characters in this story, it told him. They were strangers, really. I made them up then, just as now. I never did find out who they really were. One night I told the painter I was so much in love, I wanted to get pregnant. I said then I would be taken seriously. I would be claimed and loved. He He said that was impossible. He acted as if vasectomies were a favor or something. Well, it could be he's right. What did I know? I got dramatic. I acted very badly, and finally, I threw up. So, about the ending. It never did. It stopped. It stopped when the director found a new virgin who was rehearsing for the next play. Yes, she was small, and she was shy. She had long, dark hair. One night, we were all drinking at the other place, and he danced with her. Well, when we got to his car to drive home, he sat in the front seat with her. And he put his arm around her. I got bundled into the back seat with his red-headed girlfriend, and we went to an all-night party. I realized I was off his list. And when school started in September, I did get a new part in a new play. I got Andromache and the Trojan Women, Euripides, the Trojan Women, the spoils of war, recreation for the warrior were the women that were made slaves by wars. My acting teacher told me that I was a symbol of all the women, matrons of Troy, all the mothers in the world. I said, well, I couldn't act in symbols. Well, she explained that the general or symbolic idea could be expressed or illustrated through the suffering of the particular individual. In this case, that was Andromache. I took notes. She said I should act the role of a particular woman who has lost a specific husband. In this case, Hector, as well as that of a particular mother whose son, in this case, Astyanax, had been slaughtered by the Greeks. I tried very hard to suffer. During rehearsals and performances, I would go backstage and look at my face in the mirror, and I could see sweat pouring down. Boy, I was impressed with myself. I began to think I was suffering from magnitude, yes. Too big for my sandals. Yes, I thought about this little baby the Greeks had killed, this little child I had lost, and the heroic man that I had loved and respected and who had died defending our home, defending our city, our ruined city. Achilles knocked him down and he was out. My Trojan home and husband, all in flames. One night an old art historian came backstage to see me. He had been on the faculty for more than 20 years. He looked at me and nodded a while. Then he said, well, you are not an actress yet. I looked at him carefully. I understood this was to be taken as a compliment. I tried to look humble and wise at the same time. And I asked, well, what is it, do you think, will make me a real actress? Time and the truth, he said. The next night I was on stage watching old Troy burn and burn. The set was very impressive. I listened to the women screaming, old Hecuba, Gray and Granite in her agony. Cassandra, the priestess, Cassandra's gone mad because she knew what was coming all along. She had always known. It began to get through to me. I really wasn't tall enough to be a Trojan, or possibly too tall. I didn't know what it meant to lose a warrior husband or an infant son. On the other hand, there was something about Andromache's suffering I could understand. I think it was because I had been dumped. I understood what it might mean to be taken across the sea to Greece, to lose everything I had. I would have to live with aliens who thought I was a barbarian. I was going to be the slave of a man who didn't love me. Agamemnon, yes. Ah, well, he will die soon. He will die soon. His wife and her lover will kill him when he gets home to Greece. So I didn't worry too much about that. But all things considered, I thought that I'd been badly treated. I mean, I was only 20. I went away in summer. I went to the seashore. I didn't go with Agamemnon. I went with the art historian. He had an old place near Cannery Row in Monterey. He painted the same cypress tree every day. He played old 78 records he kept in the closet. He drank too much, and sometimes he wandered off for hours. But he looked at me as if he were seeing me for the first time. He was making a driftwood collage, or montage, or hell of a mess, as he called it. It took up most of the back porch, and he worked on that. The mornings when I couldn't wake up. I tried to cook in the rusty kitchen. Once he was painting the shore, I picked up a pile of kelp and began to drag it along the beach. He got upset and called to me to leave it there at the tide's edge where I found it. Ruining his picture, I was. Anyway. Then he said it didn't really matter. He put his paints down and walked down to the shoreline. Meet me. I threw away this smelly pile of kelp. I remember how much I loved kelp. We used to pop the bulbs for hours. Anyway, there was an iodine stink that came all over my hands. I threw away all of it. We walked together down the beach. I sat down on some rusting wreckage. I started picking at the sea lace growing in the tide pools. He found a horn of kelp and cut off the bulb at the end and blew a deep bass note through the heavy pulp. I began to hear the mermen. I laughed. He blew an even louder note. I was beginning to understand. I mean, before I went back for my last semester, I had loved another human being. I had loved someone who made broiled something for dinner each night and who ate my breakfast and who knew just how tall I was. That is a very long story in a book called Over by the Caves, published by the Berkeley Poets Workshop in 1977 or 76. Anyway, it's a nice little book. There's about seven stories. I put the numbers. I'm always being dramatic. The numbers of each chapter in Japanese. I think I was trying to get over my overly dramatic years. I just seem to think that, you know, we should always touch things up. Grandiosity and magnitude. But I settled down. I learned a lot of things. I got very old. read Emily Dickinson, and she said, "My business," said Emily Dickinson, "is circumference." I thought about that for a couple of years, and then I thought, my job, my path, my search in the world was to create synthesis. I want to cook my words, melt them down, make a new word. Anyway, I will get off the podcast now, and I will read you another story the first chance I get. This one is called Beatific Blue, Jennifer Stone, Beatific Blue, 1950. Go easy. And if you can't go easy, go as easy as you can.